You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Welcome, everybody. Hello. My name is Tim Lorton, and I'm the Executive Director of the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. Thank you so much for coming out today, the last day before your Memorial Day recess. You deserve all deserve a medal for being here. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much. This event is called Do Not Track Privacy. Is it Dead or Alive? And that's what we'll be discussing today. But before I do that, let me just get to some thank yous and some housekeeping. I do want to thank the Congressional Internet Caucus co-chairs, Senators Leahy and Thune, and Congressman Goodlatte and Congresswoman Eshoo, for helping us put this together today. Their leadership to host these kind of debates between internet companies is really important. We're really in their debt. Next week, we have another briefing coming up on patent troll litigation. That'll be on May 30th, Friday. That issue is really hot in the high-tech community. Senator Cornyn just introduced legislation to complement Senator Schumer's legislation. The Vermont Attorney General just started suing patent trolls in the state of Vermont. Really, and then there was a shield act by Congressman Chaffetz in the House. The week after that, on June 7th, which is also Friday, we'll do something called Fat Face-Off, a fact-based debate on U.S. Internet Policy and Access Networks, which sounds really painfully boring, but it's actually a really good debate about the economics of the Internet, so you can kind of better understand these really important issues like net neutrality and Netflix and some of those things. So that'll be really important. I welcome you to do that. The Twitter handle for today and the hashtag is Do Not Track. So the hashtag is Do Not Track, all one word. For anybody that's following along, and a lot of the resources that we'll be discussing will be put up on Twitter, so that you can efficiently get some of that information. So today's issue is basically on this concept of do not track, which kind of got going. It's been going on for a long time, but kind of the issue and its kind of name, do not track, it's kind of modeled after or inspired by this kind of do not call registry that the Federal Trade Commission implemented many years ago. And you all remember the Do Not Call registry where you, in order to avoid telemarketing calls, you'd submit your phone number to the Federal Trade Commission's list, and you would presumably not get calls during dinner. The idea was kind of inspired by that for Do Not Track for your online web surfing. And I'll get to that a little bit more later. But interestingly, when the Federal Trade Commission implemented Do Not Track, Do Not Call, forgive me, they didn't have the authority to do that. And some companies kind of immediately filed suit against Do Not Call Registry and won. Congress reacted immediately to that lawsuit and the Federal Trade Commission's inability to implement it. In the House, within 24 hours, the House and the Senate passed legislation within 24 hours almost unanimously to authorize the Federal Trade Commission to do the Do Not Call Registry. And I think that's an important thing to remember, is how wildly popular that registry was. So now we're at Do Not Track. And the idea is that online, are you being tracked across a variety of different websites? It's captured everybody's imagination. People have been working on this kind of idea of dealing with how do consumers kind of say no to being followed across unrelated websites across the internet and being served ads based on that, on those movements. Today, you know, we really want to look at whether implementing a technical measure to allow consumers to do that, how would that work? Is it feasible? Is it necessary? Is it wise? And that's a really good question. These are really good questions that we're going to explore today. I'm going to really quickly introduce the panelists in succession. To my left is Peter Swire, who has a long title, but it's important to explain it. He's the co-chair of the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium Tracking Protection Working Group. He also is going to the Georgia Tech as a professor, and congratulations on that. And also, importantly, in his bio, it's important to mention, he's had stints in the White House. And from 2009 to 2010, he worked for the National Economic Council. And then before that, many years ago, from 1999 to 2001, Peter served as the chief counselor for privacy in the White House under the Clinton administration. That was probably the first position of its kind I had ever heard of, and I don't think we have another equivalent to that now. press reports to the contrary. Then we'll go to Ashkan Soltani. He's an independent researcher and consultant. He has about 15 years of research and, you know, on these kind of do not, these tracking and online privacy issues. He was a staff technologist to the Division of Advertising Practices at the Federal Trade Commission, so he's consulted with them. He also was a senior advisor. advisor and consultant on the Wall Street Journal's What They Know series. You might have seen that in the Wall Street Journal over a period of years, a couple of years ago. And then we'll go to Mike Zams, who's the Senior Vice President of Public Policy, and he's also the General Counsel of the Interactive Advertising Bureau, which is a really kind of a huge trade association of online companies and advertisers. And before that, Mike also was at the UNSC's Chamber of Commerce. And then lastly, in the kind of the cleanup spot is Chris Calabrese, the Legislative Council of the American Civil Liberties Union, and we welcome all of those folks. So what's the big deal with this issue? Why do we care whether people are being tracked across a variety of different websites and being served up ads based on those experiences? Is that a problem? Why do we care? As Peter Swire mentioned in a recent Wired article, said we kind of want to go into a maternity store, not me, because I'm not pregnant, never been pregnant, and I don't plan on being pregnant. But if you go into a maternity store, you expect to see ads for diapers, and on online stores you see ads for diapers and binkies and other things. You kind of expect that when you're on that online store. But if you go to other websites across the internet, you see those same ads for perhaps diapers or things like that. Or you go to a golf site and you go to a travel site and you see ads for discounted travel to Myrtle Beach to play golf or something. People say, well, that's unnerving. Is there any harm there? And that's a fair question that we're going to get to today. I think the question is also, or is it just a creep factor, which people have never been able to define? And that's what this panel is going to kind of go into. I guess the question is, why are we here today? Forget about the fact that it's the day before World Day recess. I apologize for that before. Why are we here today? Well, many years ago, there's a lot of groups from web browser companies started implementing this kind of do not track feature into the browsers. And everybody has their favorite browser. I'm not going to do a show of hands, but whether it's Chrome, whether it's Internet Explorer, whether it's Firefox, whether you're on the Mac using Safari, when you're using your mobile device or your iPad, you have different kind of browsing experiences. Everybody has their favorite one. So these browser companies are starting to implement these kind of do not track features in a variety of different ways. And it's putting a lot of pressure on people to get together and build consensus. Privacy advocates are calling for this kind of do not track feature, as well as also omnibus privacy legislation. United States senators have introduced legislation on the topic, and it's also been introduced in the House in years past. The idea is that it really comes down to an idea behind cookies. In its current manifestation is cookies are being put on our browsers, essentially, and they're being used to kind of follow us across unrelated websites and thereby service a tailored ad based on that surfing. And again, is that a problem? Is that wise? Is there any harm there? And I think that's what I want to get to. This issue kind of kicked around in a variety of different ways over the years, starting in 2006, and people can go back further on this. But recently, and I have a timeline here, the World Wide Web Consortium, which is kind of a standards body that says, here's how we're going to make this code work with browsers, and everybody kind of gets together and says, well, that's really a good idea, let's do that. It's a standards body that really helps us create standards for our web browsing across the internet. They created something called, and Peter can explain it more in better detail, the Tracking Protection Working Group, to kind of bring everybody together, and I'll let Peter explain that. But that group has been working very, very hard, which all the panelists can attest. And they had their last face-to-face meeting on May 6th, I believe, which was just a few weeks ago, to kind of really kind of get to consensus on, is this dead or alive? Is this going to work or not? I was not there, and that's why we kind of wanted the group to come together and say, at least in this manifestation, is it dead or alive? And if not, depending on that question, what is Congress likely to do about it? They have to get their paper out by July, so we thought this would be a great time to update people on where this is, whether folks surfing the web, depending on what browser they're using, are going to be able to have some do not track feature to kind of keep this kind of tracking from happening. So with that, let me just leave it up to Peter to kind of explain more his role of the working group, because it is an important, not the only, to plain English as I can. I think it does start with do not call, because people have an intuition about how many people here have ever done a do not call opt out for your phone number. So, like, let the record show for a lot of hands up, okay? And what you do is you do step number one, you go to the web page, you do step number two, and you say not me for this phone number is basically the way you do it. There's a bunch of ways you can do user choice on the internet right now to say, I don't want this company or this ad network to keep track of me. But if you go across a lot of different internet sites, and if you do it over a period of time, there hasn't been perhaps as handy a way to do that as a lot of certain privacy folks have asked for. And so maybe we could come up with a standard. Maybe we could come up with a standard way to do it, where it would be cookies or any other technology. If we do it another way of tracking, it doesn't matter. And you could do that one-time click like you did for Do Not Call. And it would work. It would work next week and it would work next year. So persistent one-time user choice. And that way you as a user could say, I either am comfortable, I want to have a lot of sort of targeted ads, or you could say, I don't actually want to do that. I want to make a different choice. That's the idea. That's the simplest way I can explain the idea of Do Not Track. And so there's been lots of ways you can imagine doing that. The way that I'm working with right now is this group, the W3C, the Worldwide Web Consortium. That was founded by a guy named Tim Berners-Lee. He's the guy that people say invented the web, so that's a pretty good start. And he's the head of it. When you put that, you're like, what have you done in your career, invented the web? That's a good one. It was first, he was the guy. Okay. So he's my, you know, my boss's boss, as it were. He's the director of this whole thing. And they're a standards group. And what does that mean? Well, you've heard of HTML. W3C was this place where they came up with a standard for HTML. Okay, so this is not some new thing invented for Do Not Track. This is the folks who brought you HTML are trying to come up with a standard way to do this privacy-related stuff on the internet. That all makes sense. And it's an internet-based thing for the simple reason. There has to be a way for you to express your choice, to send your choice, to say, hey, me, it's like my Do Not Call, I want to send a choice. And you'll typically do that through a browser or something like that. And then somebody's got to receive the choice. So in the phone world, the telemarketers find out in various ways who they can call and who they can't. But in the internet, there's a lot of websites out there. And there's a lot of different kinds of ad networks and stuff out there. And so they have to be able to receive the signal. And if we can send it in a standard way and receive it in a standard way and know what it means, then we have something that's good for users. They get to express their choice and it works. And the servers know, the websites know what they're supposed to do. And we get this really great word that standards people love. They really like this word a lot. The word is interoperability. Right? You've heard that. You'd like to be able to plug in your phone charger for all the different kinds of phones in your household. You'd like a lot of interoperability. This way you can use any browser, you can go to any website, and we have a standard way to do it. That's the hope. And so to help make this fun and easy, we brought together at the W3C and the working group the relevant stakeholders. And as of today, I believe there's 99 different stakeholder groups. And all we have to do is get consensus among all of those, and we'll have a standard. So it's sort of Senate size. And you know that the Senate is always easy to get consensus. And so it's sort of easy to get consensus in W3C also, you know. But also sometimes things do pass the Senate. And we're over on the House side, so you can all laugh about how rarely that happens. But we have some Senate staff also here. Look, we all to town for as long as we lived in town. Okay. Anyway, my own role is as a co-chair of this process. There's a very good engineer, a person named Matthias Schunter, who's working on the technical part. How do you send the HTML header? You really don't want a law professor running that part of the process. The part that I'm working on is what it means to comply with the standard. When you send and receive it, what does that mean for users and for websites? And I try to play the role of good listener or honest broker, or press is sometimes called a mediator. I've worked with a lot of different parts of the industry and the privacy community and the government, and so I'm trying to facilitate a process. So what that process means, and all I'm going to let others say, and I'm probably after we come back through the panel, I'll say a little bit more about what happened recently, but here's this effort to come up with a consensus that gives you as users a choice that actually works. That's what we're trying to do. So I'll stop there.
Thanks, Tim. So, maybe not being a technical technologist in this space, only one not wearing a tie, obviously. And I actually wore this shirt for two reasons. One, that I'm a technologist, and two, I feel like this industry has a bit of kind of attention deficit disorder. Microsoft and basically Netscape Mozilla at the time, announced features to allow users to block these third-party cookies and to maintain some privacy with regards to being tracked online. But again, the same issues came up, which is what were the defaults? And back then, again, the defaults were that users had to know about the tracking and learn to block and define this setting, and it was very hard to do. And then the other issues were one with exemptions, right? So some of the opt-outs at the time would still allow companies to track users and identify them uniquely, even when they didn't want to be tracked for the purposes of, say, measuring how often a user visits your website. I'll come to that in a second. But it's contrary to when users think they're opting out or blocking tracking. And then there's the issue of what is consent. You know, so what a user opts in, what are they consenting to, what are the privacy policies say, what are the terms. And these are exactly the same issues that were in the 2000 era, same issues that started at the beginning of the W3C process about 2 years ago. And they're currently kind of the big sticky issues still. And to kind of summarize them, the idea is how much tracking do we want to allow? How much tracking do we want to enable in this industry? And I think one of the key ways to understand the context of this is kind of the dirty little secret that not a lot of people discuss, which is it's not just about behaviorally profiling you or knowing to serve you, you know, pet ads if you have a pet. It's also able the ability to for bunch of different people in this space to uniquely measure that you are you and you've visited this page, you know, 1,000 times or visited this website 1,000 times over the course of a year. Or when you visited this page, you've gone to another website and purchased something, so the effectiveness of that had to be measured. And this ability to track uniques is effectively the currency in this market, right? The unique tracking is how a publisher goes to an advertiser and says, we had this many conversions, or we served this many uniques on our website, pay us this much, or vice versa. And so I think this is one of the big sticking points, is that in this debate, a lot of people still want to maintain this ability to track people. And as a result, goes against what we think of as do not track as being completely anonymous, because there's a record of our activity being maintained somewhere. And so there's been a bunch of technical solutions in this process that are interesting, such as DNA identification or retention limits to address these things, retention limits being don't store information for more than you need to, maybe store it for a month. There's been a bunch of browser tools and technology solutions, which we'll probably talk about, that are supposed to help block this and help consumers have choice. But in fact, most of my research has shown that companies, because of the incentive to uniquely track people and because of the fact that this is currency, have found ways to go around consumer choices when they want to opt out, when they want to block cookies, when they want to remain anonymous. And if you look at my research on flash cookies or third-party tracking, there is this arms race where there's incentive to go around consumer choice. So the question is, what can we do? And so this is the idea behind Do Not Track, was to, in addition to the technical mechanisms, come up with a policy mechanism. So while Peter describes this as a technical process and a technical standard, it's really a policy mechanism. It's a voting mechanism where you can, as a user, express your interest with regards to privacy to a bunch of websites or a bunch of third parties, and they can respond accordingly. Right? And so it's more of a policy that it's like raising your flag. It's not a high-tech technical standard, right? It's just like wearing a dot on your shirt or on your driver's license that says you don't want your organs donated. So I think it's important to realize the context that this comes to and also realize the opportunity, right? So what ends up happening by providing a kind of centralized or reliable, easy way for users to express consumer choice is that you bring this issue of third-party tracking to the forefront, and you allow people to engage and decide what amount of tracking they want to allow. You also allow the industry to come up with new innovative ways to, say, get information. Like, for example, if I like bicycles, I'm happy to disclose that to a lot of third parties and get contact related to bicycles, especially if the contact facilitates the websites that I want to see. But I might be sensitive about different things. I might not want to say I'm dieting or I like sugar-free sodas. Maybe that's something I'm sensitive about. So I want the ability to be able to choose what I express and what I don't express. And I think by using a technology or a technique that brings this issue of tracking and targeting to the forefront, I think you allow a better market and a better working ecosystem with regards to advertising and marketing. And there's a real opportunity there.
Well, thank you. And one thing, before I go to Mike, I want to mention that I didn't do my opening, which I think is really important. I did mention it, interestingly enough, at a briefing we did 2 weeks ago on Spectrum. And wireless mobility. The idea was that the panel had like need for this kind of spectrum. spectrums for what's crunch and to have our mobile devices be able to download the content that we want. The idea where I asked the question was whether or not the bandwidth constraints on mobile devices would prohibit users from accessing kind of full as much advertising and the types of advertising on their mobile devices as they do on their PC or in their homes. And the idea is that if people couldn't access advertising on their mobile device because of bandwidth and constraints, the advertising platform that enabled free content on the internet as we know it today would not be available on mobile devices. And it was a question, it's not a conclusion. But we sometimes take for granted the fact that advertising has generated kind of the free services that we really take for granted today. And before I went to Mike, I just wanted to say that we mentioned that last week in a Spectrum panel, but that's kind of an important part of this conversation is what is the role of advertising plays here?
I think that's right. Thanks, Tim, for bringing this panel together and addressing this important issue. and also for making that pitch for the importance of advertising. It's a homegrown industry here in the United States. It's a $36 billion industry that provides over 3 million jobs to American workers. And it's been a robust growing industry by about 15% year over year the last few years in a relatively down economy. So we have to recognize that innovation and economic growth is a part of every policy decision that we make for the internet. And that's why I think today's discussion is really great. So at IAB, we're here to ask the question, why are we here and why do we care? Well, I can tell you that IAB is 500-plus member companies who create original content and services that are largely freely available for users because of the advertising and supports that content and the services. They're here because they care about consumer privacy, and that's because consumers care about privacy. They care about how data flows online, and they care about the experience that they receive in the digital ecosystem. And so we need to find that right balance. And that's why IAB is here. That's why we've worked with our industry partners at the W3C. It's been a long process, but it's not likely, even if the W3C ends today, you never hang a banner and say we've figured out privacy. There's always going to be a new challenge because the industry is going to continue to evolve and grow, and consumer expectations will continue to evolve and change, and we want to meet those consumer expectations. And we think we're doing a pretty good job. That's why IAB was one of the founding partners with the entire digital supply chain to come together and to create the Digital Advertising Alliance, which is an industry self-regulatory program that was lauded by President Obama's administration last February, when they released their Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights. And they held the DAA program up as a model of success for how industry can self-regulate and create what they call enforceable codes of conduct. And what that means is that we've literally revolutionized the way consumers receive information about how data is collected online. This transparency principle. And if you haven't seen it, once you look at it, you recognize it. If you haven't seen the ad choices icon, it's being served in more than 1 trillion ads every month. That's revolutionary as far as consumer notice. We've also expanded consumer choice and empowered consumers to make a choice if they don't want to have data collected about them, about their browsing behavior, which is what we're really talking about today. As you traverse the internet, you go from site to site. If you really have concerns here, a lot of consumers do, we empower them very simply, one click to opt out of virtually the entire digital ecosystem. About 120 companies now participate. So there's a lot going on in this space. There's a long history in AI for more than a decade, and AI has been a great partner at the DAA, and they're expanding their program. All of these things are meant to sort of meet consumers' privacy expectations. But we recognized a year ago when we were at the White House and they were supporting our system, then there was a next phase of this. We could do better. We had to continue to evolve as an industry through self-regulation. And that was when we made a commitment to try to work to incorporate browser tools. And that's what we're really talking about at the W3C is how do you, as a user of the internet, you use your browser every, you have to by definition. exercise choice. And that's why we're working with the W3CS, why we're also working within the industry to try to come up and, with other ways to empower consumers. And that's what this is really about. You know, the nice thing, too, about self-regulation is it's becoming global. We've rolled out a European DAA. We're about to roll out a Canadian DAA. We're working in South and Central America on self-regulation to have, as Peter said, interoperability. And not because we want interoperability for companies, but because users, global internet users, want to have a seamless, easy, usable experience when it comes to privacy in the online space. And that's something that I think only industry self-regulation can really achieve. And so the second question you asked was, is this dead or alive? Do not try. And it's very much alive. And I think the W3C process is very much alive, largely because I think when Peter joined as a co-chair, he breathed new life into it, and that was refreshing. And I think that there's a real opportunity to get something done that's good for users and that is good for industry as well. But I think the key is going to be focusing on the technology. I think when you look at there are two documents, one is a technical specification of how browsers sort of talk to each other, how servers on the back end talk to each other. And then there's the compliance doc, which is what are the least sort of legal obligations. Now, every W3C standard is voluntary, so it requires industry to voluntarily agree to follow whatever the W3C comes up with, which is why getting the language exactly right is key so that we have broad adoption, like we have had with industry self-regulation. But I think there's an opportunity to advance consumer privacy there. I think the technical side is not that difficult. I think figuring out a consistent way for browsers to present this tool to users, a consistent way for servers on the back end to talk to each other, you know, sort of this signal, this response. The compliance one's tough, but we're working sort of hand-in-hand in partnership with Peter and privacy advocates, academics, and regulators at the W3C.
Chris, you represent a rather large union of folks. Why is this really necessary? Why do consumers care about this? Is this an issue? And also, like, where is their agreement? I'm trying to figure out where the agreement and the disagreement is here, if there is any.
Oh, there is. Thanks. It's funny. I've been listening to my various panelists. I've been revising my remarks a little bit on the fly, which is always dangerous, so bear with me a little bit. I think one of the things we haven't really talked about yet is that why should we care? Why is this a big deal? So I'm going to try to kind of lay out a few scenarios, right, that I think illustrate the particular potential harms. And I'm not saying all of Mike's members are causing these harms, but I want you to sort of understand the basic framework that we view this through. What we believe, at least the ACLU believes, and I think that quite a few consumer groups do as well, is that one of the problems with this sort of collection of information and this tracking, especially when you are not aware of it, is that it creates a power imbalance, if you will, an information imbalance. In other words, other people know things about you that you don't know about them or you don't know they know. And so what does that mean? I mean, that's sort of very abstract, so let me try to make it a little concrete. The New York Times did a great story a couple of years ago, actually a very sad story by Richard Guthrie, who was a very senior citizen, a war veteran, somebody that, you know, I believe he was a World War II veteran. But in his old age, he had become a little bit senile, and a little bit of a tough time making decisions on his own. Well, he had been targeted in a marketing database as someone who would be a sort of an easy mark, someone you could sell things to. And, you know, he had been built out of substantial amounts of money because he was identified as someone who you could call and he'd answer the phone and you maybe could get him to buy a product that he didn't need. Now, that's an extreme example, but I think what we see is if you can use the information you collect about someone, you can make decisions about them. I'll give you another example. The Target company does a very good job of targeting consumers. They do a good job of identifying what consumers might want to buy, which is often not a bad thing.
might start to send a mailer saying, hey, you know, good news, you might want to consider buying all these other things. Well, apparently they had an irate father come in. Why are you sending this to my daughter? What is this? This is completely inappropriate. She, you know, you're targeting her for baby supplies. She's only, I think she was 16 or 17. And, of course, he had to come back about 2 weeks later, sort of chagrined and embarrassed. Well, seems like there were some things going on in my house that I didn't know about. She was pregnant. You know, information is revealed that you may not be aware of, that you may not know that you were revealing. And, you know, what I think is perhaps even more troubling is that this type of information, when it's collected, can also be integrated with other information that you have, offline information, like, for example, how much money you make, right? Which is obviously something that's of great interest if you're an advertiser, you know, knowing who's a consumer is really. And so what Target does is they send you coupons based on things they know about you, like how much money you make. So if I'm a wealthy Target consumer, I may get a $10 coupon because I know that's how much it takes me to get me in the door, right? Whereas if I'm a lower income, you know, customer, I may only get a $2 coupon because I know that's enough to get you in the door. Well, that's a, you know, we could have a sort of long discussion about economics, and but it's clearly knowledge that you didn't realize you had released is being used to sort of deprive you of a certain benefit, or at least a possible benefit, and that's something that I think we have to consider here. I think that we want to bring in Do Not Track mechanism, at least the ACLU does, in order to help consumers sort of level the playing field. And I think that, Tim, you asked about sort of who has the benefit, like who's, you know, why should industry and others come on board? And I think you can hear from Mike that industry does think there's a benefit. Now, try to lay out a little bit why I think that is. I think there are still a significant category of people who are afraid of the internet. Like, they don't know what's going on there. They worry about things like tracking. There are still a lot of people who have not plugged in yet. And I believe that giving them tools like Do Not Track that allows them to control what information is collected is a great way to start saying, no, you don't have to worry about this tracking that you may not be aware of and be fearful of. In fact, you can, you know, participate without tracking. And I think that'll help bring people on the internet. I think that benefits everybody. Parochially, from an ACLU point of view, we worry about tracking not just by industry, but also by the government. And we fear that this type of information collection can also be accessed not just by customers, can also be sold to the government, can be collected in a wide variety of ways. And the ACLU views the internet as one of the most powerful tools for exercising your First Amendment rights since the printing press. Right? Yeah, you can speak, you can learn. These are tools. This is a tool that's unparalleled in its value. So, but if you're afraid to go on a particular website because you think that that may put you in a certain profile or class, that that may target you in some way, you may not want to learn about sensitive information. You may not want to delve into areas or join particular groups. And we think all of that harms your First Amendment freedoms, and that's one of the reasons we think the Do Not Track mechanism is a powerful way to create a shield for you so you can do those things that may be controversial or sensitive. You know, with all respect to the good work you guys are doing in terms of self-regulation, we don't think self-regulation is enough. We believe that all of you policymakers have a crucial role in passing some kind of baseline legislation that creates a do-not-track option of some sort. It's the law has a real power, right? It means it can't be changed by the fine print. It means a company can't decide to opt out of it. It means this is a legal, this is a protection I can count on. That means a lot for building a do not track mechanism that's meaningful and, again, doing all those positive things that I was discussing. I also believe that self-regulation does a good job of getting industry to sort of do what they think are best practices anyway. Right? You know, all the good guys in a particular industry want to do certain things. But if something is an industry norm that we think needs to be changed, everybody in the industry agrees that they're not going to pass a self-regulatory regime that changes what is essentially integral to the industry. And I think that tracking is, in many ways, integral to a portion of the advertising industry. I don't think the whole advertising industry by any stretch, should all be able to control whether we're tracked online.
Okay. And part of the main reason we're here today, the day before the holiday recess, is that this tracking protection working group of the World Wide Web Consortium just had its last face-to-face meeting. We had a July deadline. And one of the main questions I wanted to ask you folks today was whether this do not track feature, at least as embodied in the World Wide Web Consortium process, is feasible. So I think I'd have to ask Peter, where are we today?
Well, I think where we are today is pretty well represented in a one-pager that came out of the meeting. And it has a sort of nice title. It has the first word I really like. It says consensus. That was a good word. Consensus action summary. And so I'm going to briefly mention sort of the four points that were in that, if that's okay.
Yeah, it's in layman's terms because I read it.
I'll try to say it in English. I've been a teacher a long time, and, I'll try to speak English. But before we get to the four issues, the key part was that there have been quotes in the press before we met on May 6th, 7th, and 8th out in California. There have been quotes in the press that this thing was going to die. It was just going to blow up that week. And instead, the key language is there was sufficient progress during the meeting to merit moving ahead towards our July deadline. And that was signed on to by the privacy people in the rooms and the advertising people and the browser people. That was the room. And so I think that's interesting to note that everyone said, look, we're not abandoning this thing. This thing should go forward. So the four issues, and I'll say it in English. The first one is about audience measurement or market research. And here's why this is here. The DAA, the Digital Advertising Alliance, and Mike's group is very much part of that, put out its code about good practices. And they said in the code back a year ago that there were collection limits, but there were a couple of important exceptions. And one of the exceptions is if you're doing market research and you don't target it back to Tim, you can gather all the data you want, basically. And in my testimony in the Senate last year before I came into all this, I actually went to the DAA and said, this looks pretty wide open as an exception. Do you think we can do something to change this? And at that time, and since, the advertising industry says, we have to come up with new language here on measuring the audience size. You track people partly to sort of send an ad to that person, but you also have a lot of the cookies and stuff to see how many people came here and what was the demographics and stuff. So we're trying to figure out that market research part so we can say what's in and what's out for collecting.
Can you give an offline example of that? Like, when I say offline, are we talking zip code? Are we talking about blog? Are we talking about mail?
TV. Is it women or men that are watching American Idol this year? Is it southern or northern? Why do the southerners seem to last longer than northerners get kicked off? So there's audience measurement demographics for lots of reasons. And there's a lot of reasons in advertising you want to spend money where the people are that you care about. But that could turn out to be a lot of data about the people. And so that's why it's partly privacy and partly a normal part of advertising. So the second issue is, how do we do the sending and receiving? What's gonna show up in the user's eyeballs when the user gets to the browser? What's it going to peek back and forth with the websites? And the advertisers and the browsers and others have been having some good conversations about that. The third one is, once the data is collected, do you keep it forever? And do you keep it sort of full form forever? And if you're going to address tracking, then keeping it in your database forever seems sort of like tracking to a lot of people. And so maybe what you do is you scrub the data over time so that you might have aggregate statistics, but you don't have a link back to Peter or Tim. So you scrub it. And how long until you scrub it? And how hard do you have to scrub it? That can be called de-identification. It could be called data retention. But there's a sort of, what do the sites do with the stuff they did collect? And we've worked a lot on that, and it's an area that I've worked on previously. So data hygiene, how long do you keep the data? So those are three areas, market research definition, the send and receive, and how do you scrub the data? And then the fourth point said that there will be ongoing discussions of unique identifiers as a critical issue for advocates. And we're inviting proposals on ways to solve this issue. So from the privacy side, what they've said in the meetings is, look, I turn on Do Not Track, and then as I go around the web, somebody's actually still putting a unique cookie on me to identify me. That shouldn't be the way it works with Do Not Track. And if you sit back, wait a second, we have to have security for our systems. Wait a second, we have to debug problems when they happen. Maybe we have to keep track for accounting reasons and stuff. And so there's a back and forth where the privacy side has really said, let's move to a world where we don't need those unique identifiers. And industry up until now has said that's not practical. were some magic technology that could get good advertising and not have the unique tracking, then that would be very attractive. And so there's an invitation for people to try to find ways to do that. So those were the issues that came out of our consensus document this month.
So this is a consensus document. So I love that as the panelist, and I'll frame it in those terms. Does this document mean, as Peter says in number four, we're moving forward towards a document? When this is done after July, does this mean that, what does it look like when the users in the audience or at home want to download the latest version of Firefox or Safari or Chrome, their favorite browser, they'll be able to, it'll do this to prevent tracking? And what does that look like? How does that play out? Do we have consensus for that to happen?
We're not allowed to talk about what that will look like in the W3C. That's the irony of this, right? We have browsers in our to present an opportunity for a user to express something.
But we're not at W3C.
Right. Tell you guys what this looks like. And I just last week it's important for us to understand what it will look like
okay.
First. And then we can talk about what it might look like. I think that's helpful because we're having a discussion about, can browsers present something to users? But at the W3C, we're not allowed to have a discussion of what that should look like, what we call user interface. So we're trying to have that discussion, and we're also trying to work offline with some of the browser companies, because certainly if we're going to present something to users, it should be clearly stated. It should be, I'll just circle back to the agreement we had with the White House a year ago. And what everybody agreed to then was that we should have a consistent user interface for browser controls such as this. And it shouldn't be turned on by default. It should be a user's express preference, which actually is this group. It's not the do not track working group. It's the tracking preference expression working group. And so what we want to do is protection. And we want to give users a voice to express their preferences. That's key. So I'm not sure.
So when the user downloads the latest version of Firefox, your imagination of how this ended, we're not at W3C, so I think you won't get penalized. The user will have to do something affirmative to turn on that preference to choose to not have this tracking issue happen.
We should have users expressing a preference.
Is there consensus on that?
I was just going to say, it might be sort of surface-wide. We don't necessarily agree with that. So, to kind of try to boil this down, it's kind of an interesting question, right? Like, people tend to leave whatever the default is, whatever you give them is what they leave on, right? So if it's do not track is on, they may leave it there. If it's off, they may leave it there. So it's actually a really big question. I think the advertisers, and correct me if you think I'm mischaracterizing you, have said that they believe it's an unfair choice to present it to consumers as on.
You should believe it's a consumer expression in a company such as a browser makes the decision to turn on do not track. You know, by the way, that was the very first area of consensus that the W3C working group agreed was that it should not be turned on by default. Advocates, regulators, academics, and industry have agreed on that position for well over a year.
So let me finish this is really crucial. Why is it a choice if it's given to you off and you turn it on, but it's not a choice if it's given to you on and you turn it off? If the tracking has such value. I think that's kind of not to be a dead horse, but it's the same issue that we saw. The defaults are 99. 99 was an opportunity to do something, and the question came down to what should the defaults be. And I think the general consensus you get is that as long from the ad industries, general is as long as it's hard and not a lot of people do it, then we're fine with whatever it is. But if, in fact, there's a decision, say 10, 13 years ago, to decide what the default should be, then there's no reason it has to be that now. It's kind of like if I happen to be gardening in your property, and suddenly you say, you know what, I'm going to take that back, right? But I would say I have a thriving, farm share based on your property. It still doesn't give me the right to actually come into your property. I mean, I think that that's kind of the
podcast as I've done, essentially. And I think back in 1989, the first network advertising initiative agreement with the Federal Trade Commission, they agreed to kind of have an opt-no cookie, and there was no opt-in version of that. That seemed to be satisfied to the Federal Trade Commission at that time.
Right. So I think that the proliferation of tracking has actually gone up quite
a bit. Okay, so something's changed.
And just to finish, there's no reason to default to be one area. Microsoft, for example, has presented on first launch of the browser, you ask the user to make a decision. Safari, the Apple browser, has for a long time blocked a lot of these mechanisms by default. Anyway, right, so Safari out of the box blocks a lot of the third-party tracking mechanisms. I think the assumption that it needs to be one way or another is just, I think, a false assumption. Right? We can actually prompt the user, we can allow, I use antivirus software, I use a firewall. Maybe I want my firewall to, by default, block all this tracking as well.
Let's unpack that a bit. There's been a dizzying number of press accounts in this piece, and some of them aren't accurate. It's like, you know, Jennifer Lopez and what she's doing lately.
Has it ever been compared to Jennifer Lopez?
You have now. Sometimes they're accurate, sometimes they're not accurate. I don't even know. We invited all the browser companies to participate today, but, you know, because of the West Coast nature of most of them, they are not able to participate. I guess there's been a lot of discussion, though, where are we now? And there's talk about, you know, turn this on by default. Some of them are. Some of them have backed away from that. Can somebody give me an assessment of, like, for people who have their favorite browser, where people are on this, browser companies?
So Safari, out of the box, blocks third-party cookies by default.
Discussion about browser controls.
No, we're not, because I could go into more detail about everybody's favorite browser has different things. Like, when I don't want, if I'm looking at something that I wouldn't want other people to look at, I go into incognito mode in Chrome. Or if I'm in Internet Explorer, I go into in private browsing. Or if I'm on Firefox, I go into, I forget what the term is. You can kind of, you know, mask those things, or you can also use, those are browser controls. The cookie controls have been around for a long time. Now, we're talking about the actual implementing this kind of track concept.
Right. But I don't see how to track.
Because we don't have a standard yet.
That's right.
Peter says we have a consensus, but not a standard.
The reason it's important, though, what those defaults are my research has shown, for example, when you're in incognito mode, or when you block their party cookies, or when you try to use the browser features that you're talking about, a lot of the times there are technologies that go around those preferences. So I've shown that companies like Hulu will track users even if they're across multiple browsers, even if you have two browsers on the same machine, right? So
why are you expressing a choice when you
tell me? So the argument was that patent issues, like, well, we didn't really think they meant to opt out. They just deleted the cookies, so we thought, you know, we're going to help them and resurrect those cookies. And this is not as flash cookies. And so the concept behind do not track and what those defaults are should probably reflect what the browser preferences are for the user, right? So the user should be able to say, you know, I don't want to be tracked. I want to clear my cookies, and I want to send the signal.
Mike?
I don't know what the question is. I mean, I'm happy to walk through and do a survey of what the status quo is for browsers.
Sure, yeah, sure, you can do that. And I think what I wanted to circle on is what the browsers are doing with regard to the implementation of the track. And again, we don't have a W3C standard, but they're doing something different.
I think that would be useful for this audience is to talk about the status quo, knowing that we don't have a standard yet. But the presentation of Do Not Track today, Microsoft actually requires you to, well, they probably present it. It's already pre-checked, so it's default turned on, and you have to turn it off. Safari and Chrome and Firefox, you know, they're the three, the four of those are the predominant browsers. They all basically just have it as an option in your privacy settings or some other settings. So the user has to go in and express a preference not to be tracked.
So you have to know that there's invisible third-party tracking going on and then find the setting, which is usually very good.
Okay, let's get to that. So in your browser, there's many types of privacy setting, you know, privacy, security, a bunch of things. The basic pattern had been you go to privacy, you click once, and then you have a list of options, and you click again. And that's, at some level, a little bit like do not call, because you do one step, which is you go to the website, you go to the seventh step, and click it. That's a basic approach, but then how easy it is to find or not varies. How well labeled or described it is varies, and so people can get into a lot of discussions, even at that sort of two-step go to the apps in their browser. But how hard is it? I use incognito browsing now and again. I remember most of the room, when you asked anybody to set up the do.call registry, most of the room raised their hand. They actually went to some website. They searched for do not call registry. They went to the Federal Trade Commission website, which, forgive me, isn't the most user-friendly. And they found the number, they called it, they registered it. That's a little more, that's a fair amount of work, right? Why is that not hard, not too hard? But, going into your cookie preferences is.
So I think you notice when you get a call during dinner that interrupts your dinner, right? You know that there's someone calling you on your cell phone or you're paying your minutes. I think a lot of the stuff that issues that most consumers are not aware, right, and the way this information is used is not immediately apparent to them, right? A lot of my research has shown, for example, companies that will charge or provide different offers to consumers at different prices based on their browsing history. And most consumers won't know that someone else has received a different price, right? Or consumers will, there's one company we got at the Wall Street Journal that would profile you based on the cars that you browse online, or let's say cars.com. And then when you meet up, let's say you go to the DC Toyota dealership, and you sign up to see a car, they would send that dealership the information about what other cars you've looked at. So when you're negotiating a deal, that dealership kind of knows that you really like the red Honda or the red Toyota, and knows. And this is to speak to Chris's information asymmetry points. And most consumers won't know that that's happening to go in to somebody and say anything. So to the question of everyone, there's this large show of hands of who opted out or did they do not call, how many people have ever changed upon the browser privacy setting?
Well, I guess the question is, but isn't there some benefit of actually, there's obviously a lot of benefit of advertising, as I noted. Isn't there some benefit to serving targeted ads? For instance, I had a bouncy castle, all those kids' bouncy castles, and I owned one. It was awesome. I have several more I can ask. If you do ask a question, please make it a question, not a comment, and please identify yourself beforehand. Mark?
There's a guy
out there. Well, question? No, I have a question.
Thank you. guess I'd start with, you're doing great. You are creating a business model. So you, behavioral targeting is creating a business model of profiling individual users and creating detailed summaries of all the places they go online. It is connecting all of that information, information that's been collected offline, and it is using it for a wide variety of purposes, including but not limited to behavioral targeting. I believe that implicates all the harms that I just described and is, in fact, the logical outgrowth. However, sorry, to those who couldn't hear Mark's question, he said offline data isn't covered. I think that opting out or do not track allows you to limit the amount of collection that is going into that detailed profile, allows you to prevent that kind of linkage, and actually does serve to significantly balance the harms.
I guess I would make the point that the do not track process, again, it's not really the do not track process because it's not about stopping tracking. There are always going to be necessary uses of browsing behavior for things like ad reporting, for things like click fraud, fraud, other types of fraud prevention. So the W3C group's not talking about stopping tracking, quote unquote tracking, of what the user would think. So we should be clear about what we promise to the public. I think that's really key. And it's not about stopping data collection for the exact same reasons that you have to, when I, as a user, go to a website. By definition, that website knows I am there. By definition, there are third-party entities such as an analytics firm, which helps that website know how many unique visitors they have each month. That's how they stay in business. They have to know that. And I was at that website, not like Xana's, usually through a cookie. And so that's going to happen. So we're not going to stop tracking. We're not going to stop collection. That's not what we're talking about. And it's not just about stopping behavioral advertising. What you're talking about with some of these proposals is stopping the ability to collect any data, which affects every online business. It affects their analytics. It affects the way they create their content. Almost all websites have third-party partners or at least other domains that they funnel information from that people would like to stop that from happening. This is the way the internet works. What we all want to do, and what the W3C has done, because Peter has gotten us to focus on a common consumer privacy concern, which is, I might, as a user, not want to have third-party entities collecting a long history of my browser behavior. I might want to express my interest not to have that retained for a long period of time. That's what we're talking about, trying to empower. That's what D&T really is about, not all these other things.
Well, let me, I think the second part of Mark's question was not answered, but let's just table that for a second. You did raise, Mike, the kind of semantic issue of do not collect or do not target. And from what I understand, that historically has been kind of a big discussion point among the issue. So I want to kind of explore that a little bit further, if I may, Mark. You mentioned the White House in their privacy framework announcement back in December of 2010. And Danny Weitzner, who was the deputy chief technology officer of the White House at that time, said, do not track does not mean do not collect. Rather, it means that advertisers must not collect web users' data for the purposes of behavioral advertising. However, Julie Brill of the Federal Trade Commission has, for her, one of the biggest things is do not track is just do not target. It's not just a do not target, but also when the consumer so chooses, do not collect. And I don't have enough time to read Senator Rockefeller's thoughts on this subject, frankly. But so that's the question, is it do not target, like do not serve up the advertising, or is it do not collect the information in the first place?
And I respond to that because of the process where this has been discussed a lot of ways. So the do not collect way to say it has also recently been emphasized by the FTC chairman Ramirez. This comes back to this market research thing I mentioned earlier. In the DAA multi-site code, the advertiser's code itself, part one is called collection limits when you go across sites over time. And then there are two exceptions that are quite broad and that they said they're going to address. And one of them is measuring this audience, market size, and the other is product development. I've said to the group, that if those get addressed in a way that I think they can be addressed, that I think that we could honestly say at W3C that we have collection limits that have now would now be accepted by a very wide range of actors who haven't agreed to that up until then. So it's not stopping all collection. There's a ton of collection that happens in a lot of ways. Are we going to stop all collection on the internet? Well, you can't send stuff to their page unless you know their IP address. So you're going to get their IP address. But it would be a substantial good faith way to say there's collection limits that came out of this process.
I just want to identify the other three DAA exceptions to collection. The reason I say you're not going to stop collection of data online, the non-controversial exceptions to collection, even if you were, for example, a DNT user, you're still going to have information collected about you for things like ad delivery and reporting, which is what is the economic engine of that site or service that you've gone to, and things like click fraud and security. And that's just not going to change because for that's the way the internet is protected. That's the way companies do their research. That's the way they ferret out fraud and for cybersecurity reasons. And oh, by the way, we also have legal obligations, things like SOX compliance, things like the Media Ratings Council, which requires us to collect certain information for certain purposes. So you're never going to put an end to data collection, even if you're a DNT user. You're still going to have certain data collected about you. That's the way the internet works, I'm sorry.
So I want to take the opportunity now to agree with Mike, because I thought we should do it at least once on the panel, give everybody a sense that they're not, you know, totally at loggerheads. Yes, we are not going to stop collection. But that does not mean we are all the way over at do not track means just don't target me, but do whatever else you want with the information. There's a wide spectrum there. So I think that reasonably speaking, we are going to collect some information. That makes it all the more imperative that we have strong, concrete guidelines for what that collection is and what you can do with it, because we aren't going to be able to say nothing was collected at all. Personally, I believe that's why Congress needs to get involved. That's why we need legal protections for the not-for-rights members who are good actors, but for, you know, the limited fraction of people in any society who do not want to play by the rules and are not interested in self-regulation and are not interested in doing anything but pushing the boundaries and doing more collection and creating more problematic situations. So I think that's an argument for legal protections, but I also want to note that we are not saying don't collect anything ever.
Yeah, but I have a question here, and over there, and then in the front row. Sir? Can you identify yourself, please?
Speculate on their reasoning. Certainly, I've had conversations with them. We applaud Mozilla for delaying the implementation or the incorporation of what they call a patch. We don't happen to think our basic business operations, which require cookies, is a bug in the software of their browser. We happen to think it's a $36 billion industry. It depends on cookies or some sort of unique identifier to run sites. But we certainly applaud them for that. We would like to see perhaps if we can get something on Do Not Track. Mozilla has signaled that that is their priority and that they may be willing to back away from cookie blocking. But I can tell you, at IAB, we have an online petition up. I have 955 small publisher websites that have signed that petition stating if Mozilla were to block cookies, then they would, those businesses might go under. They would be, their livelihood would be threatened. It's like it's a concern, and I'm glad it hasn't fallen on deaf ears at Mozilla.
I'm curious, do those sites also block Safari? Because the patch that's been proposed would put Mozilla in line with exactly what Safari, the macOS Apple browser, does by default, which is block third-party cookies by default. So I'm curious what those public
sites were created in, you know, in the last few years, and so they've been living with the Safari decision. And the reality is that the Safari market share is so small, 3 or 4, maybe 5%, that they've sort of been able to grandpair it. They haven't been happy about it, but it's not lost revenue. The difference now is that Mozilla, with 20% market share, a change would be lopping off 20% of their revenue. And I can tell you, that's within their operating budgets. So it's a real
problem. That sounds a lot like, if a lot of people do it, then we're not going to support it. Again, right? So if a lot of people are doing this, we're not going to support it.
Well, they didn't ask. There's no support, but there's no support for cookie blocking. It's one company deciding that they are going to technologically block cookies, which are part and parcel of website operation. And there's no agreement to it or not agreement to it. I mean, it just, they do it. It's not, that's their decision. And we ought to understand what the economic realities are. That there are hundreds of thousands of small American businesses at stake. And that's not hyperbole. They are voicing their concerns.
If you look at the history of the ad industry, contextual-based advertising is still the bread and butter of this industry. It's not targeted advertising. Right? This idea that you absolutely have to have third-party cookies to actually provide advertising online is actually false. It's not a true statement.
That's
right. You can look at companies like Google, right? And what percentage of their market share is from simply contextual-based or search-based advertising compared to OBA, which is a very recent offering by them. And this has historically been the case. This is this kind of red herring again that I think the industry says cookies are part and parcel of the way our third-party cookies are part and parcel of the way the web operates. That's actually not true. That was a decision that was made a long time ago that not all browsers supported. So Safari has not supported that decision since, I think, the very early version, since 2006.
And so what you're doing is you're limiting your analysis to online behavioral advertising. I've already identified, and that's not what this discussion is about. It's not about stopping tracking. It's not about stopping collection. It's not limited to OBA. Websites use third-party cookies. They need for all types of things, from analytics to content customization. Certainly advertising is part of that, but it's not the only thing. So when you technologically block a cookie, when you block the infrastructure for a website, you are fundamentally undermining their operations. It's not just about
that. That's actually the first point that I made in my opening, which is this is the dirty little secret. And what I said is, by blocking these third-party cookies, you can actually promote other business models for measurement, for things like I opt in to sharing certain information about things that I'm comfortable with and not others. And so I think this idea that you must have this as, again, a red herring, you can actually have a variety of different innovative business models around this concept.
And I agree, you can, well, I agree with everything except for the last statement. I agree that you can appropriately put limits on the internet and you can completely re-engineer the internet. But that's not what we're doing. That's not what anybody's interested in.
Let me ask you a question. Like, I'm a little confused. We got press accounts, which may or may not be true, about browsers implementing certain do not track features, so to speak, on their own, some by default, some not by default, some upon void, some is pulled back. Why do we need a W3C standards process to define do not track when these browsers are going to implement it anyway? Why don't we just let the market decide? And what's the worst that could happen? I mean, from Mike's perspective, I think he's very clear that it would harm, in his view, it would harm some advertising companies and really kind of take away the bread and butter of the internet. But from the browser companies, from the advocate's perspective, why should we care?
Can I take a shot at that? So I wrote this op-ed about an arms race in this area earlier this month in Wired. And users and businesses and browsers, I think, should care. And here's a way an arms race could go. So we have our current story today of how it works. And we're hoping to come up with a standard so we interoperate and so we send and receive smoothly. That's what we're trying to get to. If, let's say there's a bunch of cookie blocking that happens from the browser side. The advertising industry in its meetings has said they would then really have to seriously consider doing new tracking things that have often been called digital fingerprinting on the advertising side, which would be, instead of using cookies, other ways to tell who the user is and follow them. And there's been various privacy objections and various sorts about fingerprinting. And then some of the people on the browser side said, that's fine, try that, because then we'll figure out if you're digital fingerprinting and we'll try to stop you there. And what you see is this escalation,
potentially that breaks business models everybody has to re-engineer, but also breaks a bunch of privacy protections and choices that users have because a bunch of changes have happened to what users thought they were doing. And so I've offered to people the idea that a negotiation here, where we learn how to send and receive when we give consumers choice, is better than an escalation of technical measures and countermeasures. So that's a reason why W3C can just get us to a better outcome. Or not just W3C, it could be legislation, it could be other things, but a negotiated outcome is a better thing than having this arms race.
I'll go to this question that I got to ask you. If that does happen, let's say a browser implements a do not track feature and I can turn it on myself and I can express my choice, let's do that rather than being default. I have verbally said I do not want to be tracked, whatever I understand that to be. And let's say that in your arms race scenario, the website, a publisher, or an advertising company circumvents that choice with some other type of that technology. Is there any recourse? Is there any cop on the beat from a regulatory perspective? Who would enforce what I consider that as kind of not abiding by my choice? Is that some type of this? Is there any recourse?
Well, I think it's user and FTC official maps. But I think we're talking about two slightly different things. One is cookie blocking, which we've seen, right? We've seen companies that circumvent Safari cookie blocking. And that's not inherently a deceptive practice unless you say you don't circumvent it. And so there's nothing legally wrong with that. You're not falling outside of the law. But if a user was sending DNT signal, which is different than cookie blocking, is there a legal recourse? And the reason Peter wants a negotiated settlement or agreement is because he wants industry to agree to abide by standard. And once industry has agreed to abide by that standard, just as we've done in self-regulation, where we publicly state that we abide by that standard, we, by the way, at the DNA have an independent enforcement program through the Council of Better Business Bureaus that enforces against not just IAB members and not just DNA members, but the entire ecosystem. But then you would have, if companies said we follow DNT, and we had a definition of DNT, you certainly would have an FTC hook if they had
the trade commission.
And the hook would be deceptive practice.
So there'd be a deception going on in the filtering commission, be the cop of the beat.
Sure.
And without such an agreement, that would not be possible.
It's completely voluntary, right? So you have browsers turning on DNT by default, not just browsers. You have lots of hardware manufacturers, you have software manufacturers that turn on DNT by default. So you actually today have millions of users sending DNT. I'm sure they have no idea. But it's largely being ignored because nobody had it. There's no definition of DNT, first of all. And nobody said that very few companies have said they'll actually follow it.
But there has been a process in the past, a W3C process, many, many years ago, called P3P, where there was a standard set and there was a taxonomy about what things meant, and there was an expression of, I do not want to have this cookie be in place. And my understanding is that some companies have circumvented that. Why didn't that trigger Federal Trade Commission Section 5 deception authority?
There have been Federal Trade Commission investigations on circumvention around things like flash cookies, which is another way to circumvent. This is stanced out as the case, as well as expiring or brittle cookies like TIC, which was, I think, one of your members, right? And so, so there are essentially business models that you may not want to support, which is circumvention of user choice. And in fact, there's a lot of cases where users, I don't understand why the assumption is that users don't know that they're expressing that choice if the software turns it on by default. For example, many people in this room could decide today to use Safari because they want to block cookies by default, right? Or they can install firewalls.
Right, or they could be watching. Microsoft is running a whole ad campaign based essentially on the idea that they are a very strong privacy protective company and you should go choose their products because
their advertisements are actually mentioned do not track, from my understanding.
So, it's not like, it's not a crazy idea. If I could just make sort of another point, just...
Yes, if we get a question.
Right. I think that there are a lot of entertainment options in the world that do not track you. I mean, whether it's TV or movies or books, people still read books, even not e-books, right? So, there is a broader point. There is a value to doing this that is a general value, right, to finding an agreement, to Peter being able to broker something amongst these disparate people.
So the consensus document says we're going to be moving ahead towards our July 2013 last call deadline. Last call is a standards term that no other people ever know what it means. It basically means that we're supposed to have a text that goes out to the world for public comment. It's a lot like a notice of proposed rulemaking for people that are in regulatory agencies. You put out a full document, and then the world gives comments, and then our process responds to those comments. But it's designed, the role in the standards process is to have a real live text people get to respond to. And we're meeting every Wednesday for an hour and a half on the phone, and people are meeting on the sides, and people are working on their own. So there's a lot of work going on, and we're trying to get to that document by the end of July.
And as somebody who's been a participant in that working group before Peter took over for almost 2 years now, I think that we finally, because we've identified what we're trying to solve instead of boiling the ocean and solving for everything, we've found some legitimate consumer privacy concerns that we think that we can advance the ball on, as Chris said. I'm pretty optimistic that we can get to something. There are challenges within the W3C with their rules and their processes, and I'm not sure we'll get everything done through the W3C, but I think there's an opportunity to do some things in the W3C, and if we can't get it all done there, then there are willing partners outside of the W3C, whether it's the DAA or somewhere else, to sort of finish off the deal, hopefully.
The gentleman in the checkered shirt. Census is one of these magical terms that I'm still learning, you know, the lore of what consensus means. And I think the way to see it, a lot of the times you say a consensus study is there anything about this piece you can't live with? And there's people who might prefer it this way, prefer it that way or something, but is there something here you can't live with? That's roughly the direction of what consensus means. Not love it and cheering and waving a flag, but and then we have a challenging process because, very roughly speaking, we have consumer groups who are mostly thinking about users. We have browsers. We have the first parties that you choose to go to, the websites. And we have third parties or the advertisers and others who you didn't put in the URL. And there's regulators who care, and there's European regulators who care, and there's, you know, press and all that. And so that's a lot of different folks with a lot of different perspectives. And my own effort has been to try to see, can we get to something that makes sense for all of the major parts of it? And so that I can say with some confidence, this is better than the alternative of not having a deal. That's what I'm trying personally to get to. And I made a presentation at the last meeting about why I thought something along the lines of what we're working on met that test. Folks, some of them agree, some don't agree, there's challenges, but it's not unanimous. It's not a heckler's veto. But we're trying to get a package that people actually think is better than the alternative. Here for a second on that. So the fact that a user says you have to give me $50 if you send me your web page does not mean the web page has to send you $50. No, but well, I'm going to professors start with easy cases to go to harder cases. So a unilateral statement by a user of I want something doesn't always work. Same for the website. The website can claim you owe them $1,000 if you go to their page. They don't get the $1,000. So then the question is, have you broken some other law that looks like spyware or wiretapping or hacking? And what you have to do then, and there's plaintiff's lawyers who bring cases, and there's defendants who say they're wrong. What you do then is you have these claims that this is a hack or this is a wiretap. And there's been a lot of plaintiff's cases that have filed, and some of them have settled for money, depending on what the practices were. And so all of this is against the backdrop of our laws against hacking and spyware and wiretapping. But a lot of normal business practices don't happen to fit under our legal rules about hacking and spyware and wiretapping. So look at the facts in a particular setting, and if you find a winning case, then find your favorite plaintiff's lawyer and go get them. Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, one of the issues there is, which is a tortured statute at the moment, and there's been discussions of changing it, and one of the discussions that is split in the courts is, if I just give you some words and say these are my terms of use, and you say you don't care, is that enough to count as a hack? Is that enough to count as a violation? And some circuits have said it has to be an actual technical measure, not just words and the terms of use. So there's a whole fight to be had about Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. That has, I can tell you, not been anywhere near the center of the Do Not Track discussions. And to follow up on you, people can weigh in on this, we just have one more minute. In my estimation, the answer to whether the Federal Trade Commission was the cop of the beat wasn't at all clear from the answers that the panelists gave me either. I'm not sure how
I definitely think the Federal Trade Commission, having worked there and having brought along these cases, would be. Mark actually has a lot of enforcement internally, and so it's publicized. The FTC will go after him. I've worked with them to bring a lot of
that.
So almost every paper that I published on this actually resulted in plaintiff's actions. I'm not sure. I don't agree that CFA is the right law for this. I admit that it's outside of what you would kind of be able to enforce around cookies. I think hopefully it will come up to date in terms of legal requirements. For now, we have unfair and deceptive, which is the FTC as a regulator. And we have state AGs bringing some of these cases as well.
I'm really crestfallen because we have a lot more questions to ask, and I think we'll have material to go through, things I didn't get to, and I really apologize. I do want to thank Ashkan for wearing his ADHD shirt, because it reminds me that I have been tracking the Tracking Protection Working Group process for several years now, and I've stayed on it because I thought this was really an appropriate time to do this, but what I see is that, you know, there may be a lot more phases to go through, and I just wonder whether there's going to be a question of whether it's better to burn out than to fade away, or whether there's going to be some success with people at home their browsers can actually use this stuff. So I want to thank the panelists for their time and thank the audience and happy Memorial Day.